KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Asma Khalid. It's Here and Now. Coming up, two of the world's most prominent American Catholics, the Vice President and the Pope, meet at the Vatican.
Many conservative American Catholics, and I think quite possibly the White House, were hoping that this would be somewhat of a reset.
Also, President Trump wants to start commercial mining in the deep ocean to dig up minerals for next generation batteries. But what's the environmental risk?
We're not going to learn those things until we start exploring and extracting. You can't model this stuff. You have to measure it.
And chimpanzees may be the closest genetic relative to humans, but do they feel empathy? That's coming up on Here and Now.
After this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump's engaging in phone-based diplomacy today in his quest to end the largest land war in Eastern Europe since World War II. This morning, Trump got on a call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Putin has so far resisted direct talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to halt Russia's full-scale operation against its neighbor. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt says Trump is frustrated.
He has made it clear to both sides that he wants to see a peaceful resolution and a ceasefire as soon as possible. But as for specifics on a timeline, I won't get ahead of the president.
President Trump was also expected to speak with Zelensky. Pope Leo XIV has met with Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports the conversation comes ahead of U.S.-led diplomatic efforts to make progress on a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine.
Vance, a Catholic convert, was among the last political leaders to meet with Pope Francis before he passed away. Pope Francis and the Trump administration had starkly different views, particularly on the topic of migration. Pope Leo has already spoken out in support of migrants, and in a readout of the meeting with Vance, the Vatican described, quote, an exchange of views and calls for, quote, respect for humanitarian law and international law in areas of conflict and for a negotiated solution between the parties involved. The Vatican has offered to host peace talks to try to bring an end to the war in Ukraine. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
The National Weather Service confirmed an EF3 tornado cut across part of southern Kentucky Friday night, killing at least 19 people. In London, one of the hardest areas hit. Neighbors are helping neighbors in the aftermath.
It took hours for Sherry Shepherd to reach her home after the storms. She arrived to the sounds of people calling for help and first responders trying to reach them.
The pictures don't do it justice until you've seen it. They just kept removing people, our friends, our neighbors.
Street after street, homes were gone. Miraculously, Shepherd's was barely touched. So she turned her garage into a staging area for supplies. It's filled with things like food, water, tarps, and cleaning supplies.
We feel blessed. We're almost kind of feel guilty. We're just trying to help as much as we can.
Volunteers from as far as California have been working out of Shepherd's garage. For NPR News, I'm Karen Czar in London, Kentucky.
President Trump's domestic priorities now head to the full House for a vote, but its fate is still far from certain. The Republican leadership is attempting to secure full GOP backing for a measure the Democrats are already united against. Republican House leaders have pledged modifications to appease fiscal hawks who've been demanding deeper spending cuts, including to Medicaid, to pay for the bill's tax cuts. It's NPR. A U.S. official confirms with NPR that a Boeing 747 formerly used by the Qatari government, now parked at the San Antonio airport, has not yet undergone retrofitting. There was speculation that the defense contractor L.S. Harris Technologies had begun work on the plane, but the official said that was not the case. The official was not authorized to speak publicly. The Air Force is expected to take ownership of the plane once the proper paperwork is done, and then it will go to a defense contractor for a specialized overhaul with plans for it to be used as Air Force One. Telecommunications company Verizon is the latest big company to scale back on diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts under pressure from the federal government. NPR's Maria Aspen has more.
Many big companies are backing away from what's known as DEI after once promising to create more equitable opportunities for all employees. But now, President Trump has declared such programs illegal, and the Federal Communications Commission has taken a big role in trying to pressure companies to do away with them. For example, Verizon has been seeking approval to buy Frontier, a broadband provider. So it told the FCC that it would end many of its policies relating to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Verizon will no longer set goals to hire more minorities, and it will remove references to DEI from its websites. Now the FCC has approved Verizon's deal, and it specifically cited Verizon's promise to end DEI-related practices. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
The Dow is up nearly 150 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com.
KUAC is supported by Running Reindeer Ranch in Goldstream Valley, welcoming new reindeer calves Yuri and Heidi and Frankie. They'll be joining in on guided forest tours, yoga with reindeer, and our Music with Reindeer series. Learn more at runningreindeer.com or by calling 907-455-4998.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Scott Tong. This is Here and Now. By now you've heard former President Joe Biden has prostate cancer that has spread to the bones in his body. Today he wrote this on X, quote, "Cancer touches us all. Like so many of you, Jill and I have learned that we are the strongest in the broken places. Thank you for lifting us up with love and support," end quote. Now here's the thing. Doctors tell us some men with advanced prostate cancer can live well for many, many years. Here to talk about this diagnosis and more generally about prostate cancer is oncologist William Dayhut. He's chief scientific officer at the American Cancer Society. We should note he is not treating the former president. Dr. Dayhut, welcome to Here and Now.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on today.
What is your initial response to learning the former president not only has prostate cancer, but that it has spread to the bone?
We're always sad when we hear about a patient that has an advanced cancer. One thing, as an oncologist, I do know that the therapies and treatment are much better for this than they were, 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah. And just to be clear, at this advanced stage, is there any expectation of curing this cancer?
We generally don't think that prostate cancer that has spread to the bone is a cancer that can be cured. Although we will note that most people will initially respond to the first therapies they do receive.
Yeah. And how common is prostate cancer? Tell us a little bit more about who tends to get it.
Well, prostate cancer is actually the most common invasive cancer that you see in men. Over 300,000 cases will be likely diagnosed this year. Overall, about 8% of those actually present with metastatic disease like the former president did. The risk factors for prostate cancer, number one, is age. It's certainly much more common as one gets older. Family history is really important, too. It's probably the cancer with the greatest familial risk for certain inherited genes, such as the BRCA gene, the breast cancer gene, and then certain racial ethnic minority groups, such particularly when you talk about Black Americans.
Yeah. And in general, are we checking for it enough?
Probably not. I think right now, our recent data is in the last year, only about a third of men who were recommended for screening actually had a PSA test. And the PSA is a blood test, which doesn't tell you that you have cancer, but indicates that your risk for cancer is high enough that you should do additional testing.
Yeah. What strikes me reading up quickly for this is learning how long men can live with metastatic prostate cancers. Does that mean we've seen a lot of treatment breakthroughs to allow this?
Well, so a couple things have happened. First of all, we're better at detecting cancer earlier on. So, if you went back, 30, 40 years ago, most of the men who presented with metastatic prostate cancer presented with pain, bone pain symptoms. Oftentimes now we're seeing men earlier on with fewer bone lesions and less in the way of symptoms. So that's through imaging. And then our treatments are better. We've developed a whole new generation of hormonal therapies, most of them approved over the last 10 or 12 years, that have been shown to improve the lives of men and also lead to a longer life of men with metastatic prostate cancer. And finally, we have targeted therapies. We have now therapies which target specifically to areas of cancer which express something called PSMA. And PSMA mm-hmm. can then be, have a ligand or an attachment to things such as a radiation, which deliver targeted therapy right to the areas expressing this antigen.
Yeah. Now, Doctor, the former president is now starting a very personal journey for everyone who's diagnosed with cancer based on, you know, the information we have. What are the kinds of choices he and his team will likely face?
Well, most men who have metastatic prostate cancer to the bone will start with what we call combined hormonal therapies. And that usually includes, you know, a shot, which basically tricks the brain into telling the testis not to produce testosterone, the male hormone. And then with that, usually another drug, a pill. Some of the pills block the binding of testosterone to its receptor, and others actually decrease testosterone production elsewhere in the body. So generally, that's how most men start. In some men, you might only start with just the shots, but today, most men probably would start with the shots and the
Yeah, and Dr. Dehetz, forgive me, your audio is kind of coming in and out here, but with a minute left, as an oncologist, when you sit down with a patient who's just been diagnosed, how do you start the conversation?
Well, I talk to them that we do have treatment options, so there is hope. We may not be able to eliminate the cancer, but we really have ways to improve the quality of life. And that many men can live many years with this diagnosis. And then I talk about what's most important to the patient. You know, what are things that we'd like to focus on? And what mm-hmm. things that we want to focus on to really make sure that he can meet his goals, you know, his quality of life, minimizing side effects, mm-hmm. And anything else in particular of importance.
All right. Dr. William Dehut is Chief Scientific Officer for the American Cancer Society. Dr. Dehut, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on today. Goodbye.
Pope Leo XIV celebrated his first public mass yesterday.
Mysterium Fidei.
And there, among the many in attendance, was Vice President Vance. The two also met privately this morning, all while conservative American Catholics are hoping for better relations with the Vatican. For more, we've called up New York Times religion correspondent Elizabeth Dias, who is joining us from Rome. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tens of thousands of people filled St. Peter's Square yesterday for Pope Leo's inaugural mass. You were there too, Elizabeth, covering it all. What was it like?
It was really amazing, you know, the energy in that space. And I'd been there for the conclave not too long before, and seeing Pope Leo take the Pope Mobile up the boulevard for the first time to greet everyone. And during the ceremony, we watched him receive the ring, the papal ring, fisherman's ring he would wear. And he just took a moment to pause and look at it and grew quite moved, I think, and everyone was picking up on that.
And what was his central message in the homily he delivered?
He's really been focusing on this message of unity, being one together. I think that's a message he's really trying to bring to the church, which has been quite divided, you know, in America especially.
Well, I do want to ask you more about some of those divides, particularly in the American political context, because we mentioned that there were thousands of people there for this mass, and one of them was Vice President J.D. Vance. This morning, the VP and the Pope met behind closed doors. What can you tell us about those talks?
They did. Well, it was something that was so highly watched, given the strained relationship between this White House and the papacy. I mean, it was just a month ago when Vice President Vance came and met with Pope Francis the day before he died. Many conservative American Catholics, and I think quite possibly the White House, were hoping that this would be somewhat of a reset for their relations. This morning, here over at the Vatican, Vice President Vance met with Pope Leo first privately and then held a series of conversations with the diplomatic team at the Vatican, especially what we've been hearing is potentially even offering up the space of the Vatican for potential talks between warring parties in the future.
Mm, you're thinking, I'm thinking perhaps of Ukraine and Russia, which my understanding is the Pope had offered to mediate.
Yes, and President Zelensky of Ukraine was also here yesterday for the inaugural mass, and he met privately with Pope Leo as well. Then there was a series of meetings between the different countries and their leaders over the past 24 hours. So I think, you know, for Vice President Vance too, yes, this was a diplomatic moment, but I think it was a really personal moment for him too. I mean, he's a Catholic convert. So I think this there was a sense of these two most high-profile American Catholics in the world meeting each other. Pope Leo is similar to his predecessor. He's a bit more of a moderate, perhaps less edgy in his tone at times. But Pope Francis, not long before he died, wrote a letter to the U.S. bishops specifically pushing back against J.D. Vance's theology about compassion and immigration. And at the time, then Cardinal Prevost, who became Pope Leo, also criticized those same statements by J.D. Vance.
Well, you mentioned just there that the VP converted to Catholicism. I am curious how you've seen his faith inform his politics.
Well, he's talked a good bit about this, and he draws from St. Augustine, especially a 5th century text that Augustine wrote called City of God, which is really about the relationship between church and state at the time. And so it's an interesting potential point of discussion with the new pope, who, of course, was this Augustinian leader of the Order of St. Augustine. You know, I think we've seen some differences theologically in the Vatican's interpretation of Augustine and the vice president's, but Vice President Vance today brought the Pope a copy of that text, City of God, as a gift.
Oh, interesting. Elizabeth, I've got one final question for you here. You know, you have also reported broadly on how the vice president is part of a growing conservative Catholic movement within Republican politics. And I want to understand this better because, you know, he being VP does seem like a fundamentally different religious approach than, say, Trump's first term vice president, Mike Pence.
It is. Yes, it is. And there is a different sort of strain of conservative ideology, specifically in economics, and not just the sort of typical social issues, right, of abortion and gay marriage. Hmm. The conservative Catholic strain in the U.S. is a minority position, and even within the Catholic Church, but there are leaders in great positions of power that are elevating it to greater attention.
That is New York Times religion correspondent Elizabeth Dias. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Sometimes it seems like the news industry is one big runaway train headed way too fast, destination unknown. I'm Elsa Chang. At All Things Considered, we plan our daily voyage carefully and take the time to see the important sights along the way. Don't worry, we'll still get you where you need to go. All Things Considered from NPR News. Enjoy the journey.
That's this afternoon at 4 on KUAC. And coming up this hour on the 9:30 KUAC News, the legislature worked over the weekend to complete a budget bill before adjourning the day after tomorrow. Insurance subsidies that are ending could affect thousands of Alaskans. Also, Smoke Jumpers put out their first fire of the season. Then the Bureau of Investigation releases the names of cops and troopers who killed a suspect last Monday. Also, the farthest north border station between the U.S. and Canada opened on Sunday. You can hear these stories and more coming up at 9:30 this morning, right here on KUAC. You can find local stories and past KUAC newscasts at fm.kuac.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and Rhodes Scholar, celebrating 50 years of transformative learning adventures for adults in over 100 countries. Learn more at rhodesscholar.org/explore.
It's Here and Now. Mining in the deep sea, that is more than 15,000 feet down, is an unexplored frontier. No one is doing it at large scale. Now, there is promise in the form of nickel and cobalt and other minerals we use to make weapons, to make medical technologies and batteries. But should miners go and disturb what's down there? Last month, President Trump cast a big yes vote on that question. He issued an executive order to authorize commercial seabed mining and start the process of giving permits to companies to mine in U.S. waters and international waters beyond that. And this goes against an effective ban that most countries follow. They're part of a group called the International Seabed Authority. The ISA is connected to the UN and oversees regulations for seabed mining and is only allowed limited mining exploration. Now, the U.S. is not an ISA member, but it has respected its regulations. Let's talk now about the opportunities, the risks, and the politics of seafloor mining with Tom LaTourette. He's a senior physical scientist at the RAND Corporation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. Tom, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's talk about what's down there to mine on the seafloor. I understand there's cobalt, nickel, copper, manganese. What is the economic potential here? What do we know?
So there's three different types of deep seabed resources. And the most extensively explored and the first type that's being targeted is called polymetallic nodules. And these are sort of potato-sized mineral concretions that sit on the surface of the seabed about 4 to 6 kilometers water depth. The primary approach they're considering using is a vehicle that sort of a treaded vehicle that drives along and uses water jets to suspend the nodules and send them up a riser pipe to a surface ship. A competing technology uses neutrally buoyant robotic vehicles with grabber arms that hover right above the seabed surface and pluck individual nodules. And in both cases, the nodules are emptied onto the surface ship and then taken to shore for processing. These nodules are really, really rich in nickel and cobalt. And because of climate change, we need to decarbonize, which means we need to electrify, which means we need batteries, and lots of them. Demand for batteries is projected to skyrocket in the coming decades. Right now, you probably keep hearing China controls most of the critical minerals supply chains in the world.
Yeah,
this provides
an
opportunity to develop a new source of supply and processing that's outside the control of China's existing supply chains. So that's really a great opportunity.
So there's a geopolitical argument for the U.S. to start doing this commercial seabed mining. There's a technology arms race. There's a climate change argument for it, too, to get more minerals to make clean energy. But what else is down there on the seafloor? I understand it's very dark. It's a very cold. It's a very unique ecosystem, yeah?
Yes, it's very dark, very quiet, and there is life down there. And there are a lot of concerns about the environmental impacts of seabed mining. Research based on environmental surveys, on the impacts of early mining tests in the 70s, and observations during current mining tests and modeling indicate there certainly are some long-term impacts, particularly for the creatures that attach to the nodules. But it's important to keep in mind that all mining has impact. And seabed mining would slow the increase or possibly even decrease terrestrial mining. So the key question really is, what's the impact of seabed mining compared to terrestrial mining? Because there's no such thing as sustainable mining. Terrestrial nickel mining involves destroying Indonesian rainforest, where the biomass density is far, far greater than that on the abyssal seabed. not to mention extensive water pollution, air pollution, and worker safety hazards. And, you know, while the impacts from seabed mining are still being understood, it seems pretty clear to me that they would be far less than those of terrestrial mining.
Now, I would imagine some would argue for the precautionary principle here. That is, there's a lot, as the argument goes, that we don't know about the ecology deep under the ocean. Wait until it's safe before you mess with it. Is that argument part of this conversation too?
It is, and I think that's not a bad approach, but we're not going to learn those things until we start exploring and extracting. You can't model this stuff. You have to measure it. And if it turns out that it's not working, most of the companies I've talked to have said, well, we'll just stop. We're not going to do anything foolish or dangerous.
What has the response been from other countries that are members? They've signed on to the International Seabed Authority. They're respecting this ban, this moratorium. How have they reacted to the U.S. announcement here?
Well, the ISA itself has come out clearly and opposed to the U.S.'s position that it wants to proceed with its own regulatory system, proceeding unilaterally. And several countries have made statements, including China. And it has come out publicly stating that the U.S. should not do what it's doing. Honestly, I find that a little bit ironic, or the pot calling the kettle black, because China is pretty well known for not following international maritime law.
For years, right, it's put out, it's a version of maps of the ocean and what it considers its territory that the rest of the world disagrees with, right?
Exactly.
Now, the tension here is you have a lot of members of the global community who have joined this ISA, this International Seabed Authority affiliated with the UN, who treat a lot of the ocean as a shared resource. They want to decide collectively and together what we're going to do about this shared resource. And now we have the United States deciding that it wants to go into what's broadly considered the shared portion of this resource and mine it alone. Is that a fair way of describing where we are?
Yes, that's right. With the added complication that the U.S. is the only developed economy that's not a member of the ISA. It's essentially conflicting with the ISA. The ISA position is that the resources in the high seas are the common heritage of mankind, and the benefits need to be shared among all nations, which is the main reason the U.S. never ratified it. And now the U.S. has gone ahead and said, we're going to just do it ourselves.
We've been talking to Tom LaTourette. He's a senior physical scientist at RAND, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. Tom, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Liam and Olivia are two of the most popular names for newborns. That's according to new data from the Social Security Administration. But another name is rising in popularity, especially for girls in red states. Oakley, spelled in various ways. NPR's Netta Ulaby has more.
There are people who study names. Cleveland Evans is a professor and former president of the American Name Society. He clocked the Oakley trend a few years ago.
That one is one of those things that is coming out of Utah. Utah is sort of an early warning system for things that are going to become popular. This has to do with Latter-day Saint culture or Mormon culture. They are people who use unusual names.
This is true. So someone whose name is Dr. Oakes.
My name is Dallin D. Oakes. I'm an English linguistics professor at Brigham Young University.
Oakes has also written a scholarly article about names. He is not entirely sure why so many popular ones have emerged from his LDS culture, such as Jaden, Caden, Oakland, Oakley.
I could speculate we have more kids than some other states.
And possibly more online influencers. Oakes points out that Oak-based names are rising in popularity across the country, but when he looked at recent data from states ranked politically by the International Business Times,
every one of the top 10 red states had either an Oakland or an Oakley or both or something in the top 100 names of every one of the red states. On the other hand, and in comparison, they were only represented in two of the bluest states I sampled. clearly there's a pattern there.
So let's meet an oak, a millennial oak. Tyson Oak Carver was born in 1982.
I live in Canyon Lake, Texas. I am a realtor. I also build motorcycles and play music. Our band is called Texas Renegade.
Carver's parents liked nature-based names. He has a theory about why oak-based ones might be popular in his red state.
You know, I'm staring at a huge live oak tree out my window right now. We've got them all over the place. So that is something that people see around here, is these large oak trees.
They are established. Their roots run deep. When Oakley Grant was growing up in Kansas in the 1990s, her main association with her name were the sunglasses brand and gunslinger Annie Oakley. But she says she was named after her grandfather and an uncle.
So we love to keep these names in the family.
Oakley Grant also loves that oak trees stand for sturdy, steadfast faith.
Oak can be used as a metaphor for God's people planted by him to display his glory. I like that. I like it a lot.
But when it came time to name her own child, Grant picked something a little more uncommon. Her daughter's name is Nova. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
And Scott and I are both here in the studios with our water bottles.
Indeed we are. I am never hydrated enough, according to my spouse. She is right. But listeners, we want your help for a story we're chasing.
Yep, that's right. We want you to name your favorite summer beverage. Be whatever you want. An iced chai, a lemonade. What do you like, Scott?
I don't know. Perhaps something stirred in. Go to hereandnow.org/summerdrinks to help us stir up our fun story.
Again, that's hereandnow.org/summerdrinks. And of course, thank you. You're listening to Here and Now.
Good morning. With KUAC News, I'm Robin. Smoke jumpers for the joint BLM-Alaska Fire Service made the season's first jump on a wildfire near Central Saturday night. The Crooked Fire was estimated at 15 acres, burning about 7.5 miles west of Central. It was threatening campers and heavy equipment nearby. The fire was reported Saturday morning by someone in the area who saw it burning in grass and shrubs with some isolated torching of black spruce. 12 smoke jumpers contained the fire by about 10 p.m. Saturday and remained on scene overnight to fully extinguish the fire. They finished their mop-up and demobilized around midday yesterday. State lawmakers have until Wednesday to finish up their work for the year. Both houses worked over the weekend to pass each other's bills, and early last night they set this year's permanent fund dividend at $1,000 per Alaskan. They still must vote on a budget with deep cuts because diminished oil prices and a turbulent national economy have cut revenue. A conference committee has been negotiating the differences between what comes out of the House and what comes out of the Senate so that the same budget bill can pass through both chambers and get to Governor Mike Dunleavy's desk. Several budget items were settled over the weekend, and so was some other legislation. Senate Bill 95 is to improve access to affordable child care for working families and strengthen Alaska's workforce. The bill makes child care more accessible by expanding assistance to more families, supporting high-quality providers, and encouraging businesses to help employees with child care needs. Senate Joint Resolution 8 reaffirms the state's commitment to Taiwan, highlighting long-standing sister city partnerships among Fairbanks and Tainan City, Juneau and Chiayi City, and Anchorage and Taipei City. Taiwan is Alaska's eighth largest export market and its fourth largest market in Asia, particularly for Alaska seafood. Senate Joint Resolution 19 asks the U.S. Congress to honor Alaska's 90-10 split of revenue for mineral production on federal lands that was written into the Alaska Statehood Compact. Language in the resolution references the congressional deliberations in the late 1950s over Alaska statehood. It recognized that, as a large remote state, Alaska probably wouldn't have enough of a population nor industrial base to be self-sufficient in exchange for taking on the financial responsibility of providing public services. The people of Alaska were promised 90% of any royalties from any production on federal lands in both the Alaska Statehood Act of 1958 and an amendment to the Mineral Act of 1920. SJR 19 passed the Senate with a vote of 19-0, and then in the House, 38-2. And another joint resolution for Congress was passed last week, urging lawmakers in D.C. to extend enhanced health insurance premium subsidies. That will protect Alaskans from high medical insurance costs. Wesley Early has more.
As the highly anticipated congressional budget reconciliation bill stands now, the enhanced tax credits will expire at the end of this year. And if they don't get extended, health insurance costs will go up in January for many Alaskans. Representative Genevieve Mina, a Democrat from Anchorage, introduced House Joint Resolution 9. She says without action by Congress, 23,000 Alaskans will see their health insurance premiums rise, in some cases by four or five times.
Depending on your household size and how much you make, people will see really big increases on their premiums. And this issue significantly impacts a bracket of people who run their own business and oftentimes have healthcare access through the marketplace.
Mina says some Alaskans could be forced to find a different job that offers health insurance. The Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare, subsidized health insurance premiums for low-income Americans. The addition of enhanced tax credits increased those subsidies and added them for middle-class people making up to four times the federal poverty level. This year in Alaska, that was an annual income of about $78,000. The resolution from Alaska lawmakers says losing enhanced subsidies would force some Alaskans to choose between health care and other basic needs like housing and food. And it would increase, quote, reliance on state-funded assistance programs and emergency medical services. That, it says, would strain the state budget and resources. Representative Mina says part of her motivation for introducing the resolution is to show that there's support in the state for the Affordable Care Act, not just from individuals, she says, but legislators. That's in a state with some of the highest health care costs in the world.
It really should not be a political issue. If you look at the numbers, Alaskans will get hurt the most by the expiration of these tax credits.
Mina says the enhanced subsidies could get extended through the congressional budget reconciliation process. She says that they aren't written into the current version of the bill, but that is still being modified. And she says there could be other ways Congress could extend the subsidies. I'm Wesley Early.
Authorities have released the names of seven law enforcement officers who were involved in the fatal shooting of a suspect in Fairbanks last week. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The shooting occurred at around 10:30 p.m. last Monday, the 12th, after Fairbanks police responded to a report of a domestic disturbance on Washington Drive over on the city's west side. When officers arrived, 36-year-old Thomas Bean opened fire with a semi-automatic rifle, hitting several squad cars. Police returned fire, and several more city police and Alaska State Troopers arrived for backup. And after Bean refused to surrender, seven officers fatally shot him. Following the melee, investigators discovered that Bean had fatally shot 29-year-old Jesse Bidgood of North Pole. His body and Bean's both were sent to the state medical examiner's office for autopsy. On Friday, the Alaska Bureau of Investigation released the names of the officers who fired their weapons. The Alaska State Troopers identified are Sergeant Brent Hatch, Trooper Zachary Shacoin, and Trooper Peter Testa. The Fairbanks police officers identified are Officer Chris Conrad, Officer Nathan Jackson, Officer James Kuplak, and Officer Michael Sullivan. The Bureau of Investigation is looking into the case, and that investigation will then be independently reviewed by the Alaska Office of Special Prosecutions. For KUAC News, I'm Tim Ellis.
Also, Fairbanks Police Department reports they responded to a South Fairbanks home Saturday morning regarding some shots that were fired. Several juveniles were contacted, and a 16-year-old boy was arrested and taken to Fairbanks Youth Facility for misconduct involving weapons in the second degree. He had discharged a gun, but no injuries were reported. The incident is still under investigation, and more charges are possible. U.S. Customs and Border Protection opened the Poker Creek Port of Entry Sunday. It's the agency's farthest north border crossing that connects the Taylor Highway in Eastern Interior to the Top of the World Highway in the Yukon, which leads to Dawson City, Canada. The Poker Creek Port of Entry is located about 40 miles east of Chicken on a short stretch of the Taylor Highway up to the turnoff to Boundary Spur Road, which leads to the Yukon border. That port of entry opens every year at around this time after the Alaska Department of Transportation snowplows the Taylor Highway and opens the overland route to Canada. The port of entry is scheduled to remain open until mid-September, but a Customs and Border Protection news release issued Friday advises travelers that the agency may adjust the closing date on short notice in case of adverse weather conditions. Agency officials also want to remind travelers that passports are required to travel between Alaska and the Yukon. They say firewood from Canada cannot be brought into Alaska. More information is available on the Customs and Border Protection page on the Department of Homeland Security website, DHS.gov. And finally, a correction. We reported Friday that Kinross investor presentations suggested the Manh Choh mine's production life would extend to 2030. That date was instead referring to the Fort Knox mine north of Fairbanks. A spokesperson for Kinross says they expect Manh Choh production and the ore haul to end in late 2028 or early 2029, although it remains possible for further exploration to extend the mine's life. And a note that Kinross Alaska Manh Choh is a KUAC corporate underwriter. For KUAC, I'm Robin. Thanks for joining us this morning.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Scott Tong. This is Here and Now, with a story on an unusual Pulitzer Prize winner. This year's prize for autobiography and memoir went to the writer of a graphic novel. Feeding Ghosts is the debut work of Tessa Hulls. She writes about her mother and her grandmother, scarred by China's Cultural Revolution. And Hulls reveals this legacy of trauma in her prose and her drawings. And get this, she learned she won earlier this month at work. She makes sandwiches in the cafeteria of the Alaska State Capitol. Really. Tessa Hulls spoke to me about her book back in March of 2024. Help us understand the title, Feeding Ghosts. What are the ghosts and what are presumably you feeding them?
Well, I grew up within this family where I knew that my grandmother had been driven to madness in Maoist-era China because of what happened to her as a dissident journalist. And I sort of knew that this negative space was devouring my family. So to me, these ghosts were the unfaced past that lived within my family. And I felt like my role as an author and as an artist was to give them nourishment by bearing witness and listening to this story and finding out what it was that they had to say.
Yeah. You start the journey when you're about 30 years old. And as you say, finding your way home after running away from it and running away from your mother for years. And on one page you write, "It was the only adventure I truly feared." What did you fear?
Oh, I think I feared the vulnerability that I knew opening myself up to this past was going to create. You know, I kind of became a hyper-independent cowboy. And when I say I ran away, I went to extremes with it, going to Antarctica, yeah. Alaska. And I knew that there was going to be just a painful and rewarding softening that would come if I turned and faced my mother and faced my grandmother and really looked at what had hurt us all.
I have to say, your story, your chase, your family past, it rhymes so much with my own. I'm Chinese American and have family in the places you go to. It so intersects. But let's talk about your journey to Suzhou in China, beautiful city, where I also have some family. Your grandmother was born there. Tell us about that.
She was the second oldest of five children, and she was fiercely independent. And so made her way to Shanghai and became a female journalist reporting from the front lines of China's civil war. And so she kept writing as the communists took Shanghai, and her memoir, which she wrote upon fleeing to Hong Kong, is a record of those years of being put through thought reform campaigns and essentially documenting what would be the prelude to her own mental collapse.
Yeah. And let's talk about this. I mean, as you say, the communists take power finally in 1949, you know, after World War II, when the Chinese fend off the Japanese with the help from the U.S. and other countries, and then the communists take over. And this happened in so many Chinese families, including mine. You know, your grandmother became stained for her previous work, right? She was persona non grata. And when a family member is outcast, all of the relatives cut off contact to survive and to protect themselves. But as far as you learned, what happened to her?
My grandmother ended up having a fling with a Swiss diplomat. So she ended up a single mother raising a mixed race child while all of this was going on. And my grandfather was never in the picture. My mom never met her father. So she kind of had the black mark of both her political affiliations, but then also having a mixed race child. And eventually she was able to smuggle herself and my mother out of the country just before the Great Leap Forward. And they fled to Hong Kong beneath the false bottom of a fishing boat. Mm. And once my grandmother got there, she started writing a memoir called 8 Years in Red Shanghai, Love, Starvation, Persecution. And my mom talks about remembering her writing during those periods. And it was just this single-minded, obsessive focus. And it turns out that it was probably the first occurrence of what would be a lifelong series of mental breakdowns. And my grandmother ended up institutionalized at Castle Peak, which was Hong Kong's first mental hospital, leaving my mother to basically be raised as a charity case orphan by DGS, an elite colonial boarding school in Hong Kong.
The diocesan girls' school that your mother went to, my mother went to. And, you know, the hard part about digging up these things is we're expecting these Hallmark moments or something, and they're not, right? When we learn about difficult things and you learn, as you write, that your grandmother might turn out to be a very difficult person to like.
Yeah, I think before I read my grandmother's memoir, I viewed her as a much more sympathetic character. But there are ways in which she made very morally ambiguous and, quite frankly, calculating choices that I really tried to reconcile in the book by allowing my reader into my own confusion as to how to portray her as the complicated character she turned out to be.
Yeah. And can I ask you to talk a little bit about some of those decisions she made?
My grandmother was known to be quite beautiful, and she absolutely leveraged that to basically sleep her way into the power structures of whiteness. And in some ways, my mom was a token of her success. And because Shanghai was such a deeply racially segregated city, my grandmother was very much trying to court the semi-colonial lifestyle of basically the white expatriates who were living there.
Yeah. And how, as you think about it, does her story connect to her daughter, your mother, and to you?
I think in different ways, both my grandmother and my mother had to sever their ties with the outside world. And I realized that I was on a very similar trajectory, but had taken it in an American direction where I was severing ties because of this embrace of a really pathological notion of freedom. And I think I saw how I was on a really isolating path where the echoes of this generational trauma were going to lead me to the same place that my mom and grandma had ended up in, where we basically couldn't connect with the broader world because we didn't know how to be close to other people.
Mm. And just help us understand, do you glean that as far as your relationship with your mother, she struggled to connect with her own mother and others, and that's one reason perhaps that she struggles to connect with you?
Well, my mom was about 10 years old when her mother lost her mind, and so she really spent her entire life as the caretaker for her own mother. And so there's a way in which her understanding of what a loving relationship is was really trapped within this cycle of crisis and salvation, where she didn't know how to experience a love that didn't have some sort of damage at its core. And I think when I was born, she was really terrified that I had inherited her mother's disease because she was convinced that my grandma had lost her mind because she was a writer and the creative temperament. So from a place of deep love and deep fear, my mom tried to keep me safe from what she saw as my grandmother's mental illness lurking within me. Yeah. And that ended up really driving us apart.
So how's your relationship now since this book project has come and completed? Has it changed anything?
Absolutely. Yeah, my mom and I worked together closely on this book and actually went on multiple international research trips together. Mm. And so I traveled to China with my mom and met my family for the first time with her serving as my translator. So it's been really powerful. And I think it brought us to a place that seemed previously impossible, where we're able to understand that although we have these fundamental differences in the cultural systems in which we were raised, both of our versions of love and morality and duty can be real.
Yeah. There's a line I find really powerful, and I presume this goes to how you kind of go about your life today. Having been to China, having undergone this project, you write that China was both distant and omnipresent.
I think for those of us who are born in the U.S. to immigrant parents, there's a way in which we're both completely severed from our parents' culture and yet also defined by that absence. And for me, coming to understand my own family meant that I really had to come to understand China in a different way, because the way in which my mom and grandma had become severed from that context and that fabric, it did dominate my childhood. So a huge part of this journey was coming to understand the negative space of this thing that I had grown up with, which was China.
Yeah. Finally, Tessa, you describe yourself at the start as a cowboy who's gone on all these adventures. When you come on out on the other side, are you still a cowboy? How do you describe how you changed, if you changed?
I think I am a reformed cowboy. I still have that same quest for the frontier, but I also understand how much of that was always an illusion and was coming from a place of really deep pain. And I think now I'm trying to find a way to have a life that carries those freedoms and that sense of exploration, but is also really tied to other people.
Tessa Hulls is the author and artist behind the memoir, Feeding Ghosts. Tessa Hulls, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
KUAC and the Alaska Volcano Observatory bring you AVO Radio, an explosive two-minute look at volcanic activity across Alaska, from the Aleutians to Cook Inlet and beyond. Join us as AVO delivers a weekly review of Alaska volcanoes every Friday at 4:30 here on KUAC.
KUAC is supported by Emerald Eye Care, offering comprehensive eye health services located in the Fairbanks Costco. Membership not required. Appointments available at 907-600-0189.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Olin College of Engineering, home of the Robot Tractor, an autonomous robotics system created by a team of students and faculty who want to preserve soil health and make weeding easier for small-scale farms. Learn more at olin.edu. And the Music Emporium, guitar sellers for more than 55 years, celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. More information about their collection is at themusicemporium.com.
It's Here and Now. Those are the sounds of wild chimpanzees in the Budongo forest of Uganda. Scientists have been studying and filming these chimps and noticed that they seem to be administering a sort of first aid. Wild chimps, like the one we just heard, are specifically seeking out plants with medicinal properties for injuries. And the chimps are not just self-medicating. They also appear to treat one another's wounds. This all comes from new research led by Elodie Freiman, a primatologist who joins us now here on the show. Elodie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You spent a significant amount of time in Uganda's Budongo Forest Reserve observing wild chimpanzees. What were you looking for?
So I was in the Budongo Forest for a total of 8 months. And my focus was actually on the plants that they were consuming when they were sick. But once I got there and I started spending more time with the chimps, I expanded the scope of the research to include external care behaviors as well.
Okay. So external care behaviors, what do you mean by that? What did you find?
So that refers to behaviors that are topical. Say a chimp is wounded or injured, or say they have a snare that they've been caught in. Once we started really paying attention to how some of these plants were used traditionally in human medicinal knowledge systems, and also which bioactive properties they've been shown in the past to have, we found that several of these plants the chimpanzees are using actually have traditional uses that are specifically relevant to wound healing.
And this is something you noticed, but you also, it seems, incorporated logbook entries from previous studies in the forest going back to the early 90s. Did you notice some patterns in that previous research, and was that not yet published?
Yeah, so I spent 8 months with the chimps, but that's not that much time. So what we did was really open this study up, and there's literally a notebook in the field station where I work, where field staff members, who are the amazing local team that are out with the chimps every day, and they're really the experts and the backbone of primatology, and also researchers that have worked at the site over the last 3 decades, have written down any sort of unusual behaviors that they've observed. And I was noticing all of these entries about wound care behaviors. And so I decided to go through it and collate all of those examples. And I also talked to other researchers who are currently working at the site. And so when all of that information was amalgamated, one of the patterns that popped up, in addition to these self-directed wound care behaviors, we also found 7 different cases of chimpanzees actually helping to treat the wounds or injuries of others in their community.
That is fascinating because, you know, self-medication is one thing, but for a chimp to go out of its way to help another chimp suggests to me something more akin to empathy, right? The capacity to understand or share in the feelings of one another. I am curious what this behavior tells you about chimpanzees' empathy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think at first, when I was reading about these cases of what we call pro-social or other directed care, I assumed they were going to be between mothers and infants, say, or close genetically related kin. But we didn't find that. We found that there was actually lots of cases of chimps helping unrelated members of their community, which, as you said, has sort of more implications for empathy being involved or some form of attentiveness to the health-related needs of others, and then the ability to transfer the skills that one might apply to oneself to others.
Do you have evidence of whether these empathetic behaviors were learned or whether they were instinctual?
We don't know yet. It's still an open question. What I tend to believe is that there is a mixture of instinct and, you know, genetically encoded tendencies towards certain behaviors. And then there is also mixed in an aspect of social learning. It's likely a mixture, but I think that what's so cool about this topic is that it's still relatively new, the study of animal self-medication and animal, you know, medicine generally. And there's still a lot of open questions in the field that are waiting for researchers to come and look into them more.
Elodie, just listening to you speak reminds me so much of this question that I think many humans have been wondering about for a long time, and that is whether chimps think and feel the way humans do. You know, we share more than 98% of our DNA as humans with chimpanzees. Why is it important to study them?
I think that we have a tendency to think of ourselves as incredibly unique and incredibly more advanced than all of the other non-human animals that we share this planet with. And I think the more we study the behaviors of animals, the more we realize that there are cognitive abilities, there are skill sets, there are toolkits that we have in common with them. We're not as unique as we like to think. You know, that's very humbling. And many animals actually have a lot of knowledge about the natural world that we don't have because we've taken ourselves out of these habitats, and they can lead us to incredible medicinal resources that we might otherwise have never found. So I think that we have to start treating these animals more like our teachers.
Elodie Freiman is a London-based primatologist. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Scott Tong, like 5-6 feet away from you. So good to have you, Asma, here in studio in Washington.
Thanks for allowing me to play in this space. The latest news is next, and you've been listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com.
I'm Asma Khalid. New questions about former President Biden's fitness in office. In a new book, CNN's Jake Tapper claims a cognitive decline was covered up.
We're talking about to the point of you are not able to have a conversation. You are not able to come up with data, names that you should have at the ready.
That's next.
I can see each morn when I arrive two young cuckoos how they bill and coo. Now, Lady Bird, don't say a word, what love is in her eye. She will sigh and look away, then is when you'll hear him say, cuckoo, you got me cuckoo. No bird can coo like you coo. I'll break my wishbone, wishing for you. Take me, do. Little lovebird, I like the way your alto mingles with my contralto. We'll stick together in all sorts of weather. 'Cause cuckoo, I'm cuckoo, oh,